Welcome to Salvation by Grace, a broadcast ministry of Grace Christian Assembly, a Sovereign Grace Fellowship in Smyrna, Tennessee. For more information, we invite you to visit our website at www.salvationbygrace.org. Now let's join our teacher, Jim McLarty.
It is January 1st, 2006. And I admit that you've surprised me. We're not quite up where we were last week, but I was certain I was going to be alone here this morning. So I'm glad to see your smiling faces this morning. The fireworks in my neighborhood are ending right about now. Oh, man, the kids and I did not get much sleep because all night long, as I told Shane and Elizabeth, as the night progressed, you could hear the caliber increasing. You know, they started off with like the firecrackers in the street around 11 o'clock. And then around midnight, you know, it was all the sky rockets and the stuff exploding over my house because I live outside the city limits, so the fireworks are legal. So everybody comes to my neighborhood. And my next door neighbor is a musician with a fairly famous country singer, a really big time country singer. So his band and cronies and friends all congregate there, and they always put on firework displays that rival what they do at the riverfront down in Nashville. And then as the night goes on and the drinking continues, you can hear the gradual move from store-bought fireworks to store-bought firearms. And you can kind of hear the handguns and all that stuff going on. It's like, okay. So in any case, we didn't get much sleep, but Happy New Year to you all, and I'm glad to see you all here. And we started out 2006 with a new addition to our internet outreach. I've sent out an email to those of you who are on the email list. As of yesterday, we are now broadcasting on sermonaudio.com. We did one place last year for a little while and determined that for the cost that they wanted versus the return we were getting, that it really wasn't worth it. Anytime we do another website like that, like Sermon Audio, the purpose is to drive people back to our website where all the rest of the information is. I would suggest that if you want to download the MP3s, that you continue to download them from our website because the audio is actually better. Sermon Audio made me really squash the messages into a form that's acceptable for their servers so that people on dial-ups and people with slower connections can download from there, and that's great. Our files on our website are fairly large for MP3s, and so people downloading off a dial-up would be there all night trying to get one of our messages downloaded. But Sermon Audio I really like because they not only do they have a statement of faith, in other words, they don't just accept anybody who will pay a fee, they actually are very strict about not having charismatic stuff or word of faith making up stuff. They're not into the TBN style stuff. And they say right on there, we are committed to the Reformed faith and we're committed to the apostolic faith. And so most of the Reformed preachers, teachers in the country these days seem to be gravitating now towards Sermon Audio. So I thought we'd go jump in the pool with them for a while. And it's very reasonable. And so not going to be any strain on our budget at all. So we decided we'd go ahead and try it for a few months and see what comes of that. So we started 2006 by expanding our outreach yet again. This morning, we are in Luke 23. Before we get right into Luke 23, I just want to make a couple comments about these last couple of Sundays because it's been interesting watching the church world react to the fact that both Christmas and New Year's fell on a Sunday. You all know, because it's been in the press and been bandied around the internet all over, that a lot of the bigger churches, including the big Baptist church up the street, just closed up for Christmas, just shut the doors, just not open. Which, you know, there have been a lot of opinions out there and a lot of articles, a lot of people saying, you know, can you imagine the hypocrisy? Or at very least, it just seems strange that on the very day that they're all saying, put Christ back into Christmas, that that would also be the day that they would not show up for church. But I've been thinking about it a lot this week and having people send me emails about it, and I'd even posted one of the emails I got onto my blog because it was just so well said concerning that whole question. But I think what's happened is that the church world has one more time forgotten why the church exists, what the purpose of church is. Why do you think most of the mega churches close down on Sunday morning Christmas, and many of them are closed this morning? What do you think motivated them to say, you know what, we'll just close, that'll be easier?
Profit.
Profit driven by? By what?
Attendance.
Attendance, exactly. Attendance is going to be down. And so some of the people in the choir aren't going to be there. Some of the musicians aren't going to be able to be there. Some of the performers and actors aren't going to be able to be there. So that means we're not going to be able to pull on a full-scale show. And attendance is going to be down. And so should we really rehearse with a, you know, a smaller group to put on a show for a smaller crowd? Or should we just close the doors because attendance is down? And it's because they are thinking about their audience. And they have forgotten who the audience is.
And the entertainment. I mean,
and the entertainment.
For the entertainment, well, we got something else more entertaining that's going to be going on. So.
Right, exactly. Christmas morning at home giving gifts, that can be more entertaining than what's going on at church. And then they'll cloak it in, well, it's family time. But you know, our God is also a jealous God. And like it or not, our God is also a God who expects worship and who also expects sacrifice. Who does expect his people to prioritize him over everything, and that includes Christmas and your New Year's parties and everything else. Because if you forget who the audience for church is, then it's real easy to say, well, we won't meet or we'll shut the doors or we'll whatever else, because the audience won't be as large or the audience won't get the same entertainment value because they've begun thinking of their congregations as an audience or even as a paying audience. You know, if we open the doors and turn on the lights and rev up the smoke machines and have to run all the electricity and stuff, and not as many people show up, we're going to operate at a loss this week. So we'll just shut the doors and won't have to go through all that. The audience of church is God. Don't ever forget that. We corporately are here to worship and to praise God, and he is looking on as we worship him. We collectively as a body join together for the purpose of worshiping and glorifying our God. And so the question is not, will the audience be smaller, or will the performers be there, or will the preacher be there that week, or will all the deacons and elders show up? The question is, will God be there? And if God will be there, then you better be in his house. Because he's there expecting his people to worship and to praise him. And if that takes some sacrifice on your part, okay. Because God expects sacrifice on your part. But the modern church has decided that if they can make it more fun, more convenient, more comfortable, they can attract more people, and they are attracting them not by doctrine or not by telling them the truth about their own sinful estate and their need for a Savior, and not telling them the truth about a God who absolutely expects you to spend time before him, worshiping him, thanking him, glorifying him for all the things that he's done. It just doesn't seem to me that it's that difficult to a God who has given all of us homes and food and breath and clothing and reasonable intelligence. It doesn't seem that we couldn't just put down our Christmas gifts for a minute and get to church and then go back and say, thank you, God, for all these gifts. Look at all the gifts. And it doesn't, by the way, seem like a harsh thing to me to teach that to your children, to teach God from their earliest years that God gets the priority. God does not think it is too much to expect every man who could travel in Israel, no matter how far away you were, if you were an Israelite, if you were a Jew, it didn't matter if you were living in the far reaches of Babylonia, you had to travel three times a year and you had to get to Jerusalem. And you had to be there and you had to worship him. And if you didn't, he wouldn't drive away the devourer for the next year for you. If you didn't come with your first fruit and bring him the best of everything you had, the best of what you had, your best animal, the one that would have been best for mating, that's the one you bring God. The best of your first fruit, bring that to God. The best of your wine, the best of everything you had, you took to God to thank him for the fact that he provided for you the whole rest of the year. And if you didn't do that, he quit providing.
And even then there was a convenience that someone decided, don't travel all the way down there. It's a little beer.
Come on, right, exactly. And how did God take that? No, wasn't real big on it. No, exactly. Because people always have done that throughout history. You can certainly read it all the way through the Bible. There have always been folk who have said, oh, God doesn't mean it that way. There's an easier way to do it. We'll just have our own meeting over here and we'll bring our own animals or just bring some money and you can just buy the animals that are being sold there in the marketplace around the temple and go in the temple and buy a spotted, weak, sickly animal and give that to God. He'll understand. There have always been people who have said, oh, God will understand. Well, the first message of the devil when he showed up in the Garden of Eden was, has God not said that you can eat of every tree in the garden? And Eve said, well, every tree except that one in the center of the garden. And he said, oh, God didn't mean that. That message has been around forever. The, oh, God doesn't mean that message. God does mean that. He does expect that. And I think as the church world, in quotations, continues to ape the world and be more like the world and compete with the world for that entertainment dollar, they're going to continue to misunderstand why church exists in the first place. And it will be less and less a body of believers gathered together to worship their God and more an audience of strangers who have come to be entertained. And that's sad, and that's disturbing. But as I keep saying, the cure for wrong use is not no use. The cure for wrong use is right use. So we will continue to meet here on every Christmas Sunday and every New Year Sunday, and we'll gather and we'll worship our God, and we'll thank him for the other 364 days a year that he gives us. And it just seems to me that a God who asks for 2 hours on a Sunday morning just doesn't seem that difficult. You make it to work at what, 8, 8:30, some earlier? Church, 10:30 to 12:30, more or less. Does that seem like a lot to ask? Just doesn't seem like a lot to me. Your boss will ask for that. You say, yeah, well, I give him 40, 50, 60 hours a week, but he gives me a paycheck. For 2 hours a week, God will give you eternal life with him in glory, and that doesn't seem fair to you? No, it's too difficult. We're going to stay home and exchange gifts and just shut the door of the church. Makes no sense to me at all. Yes, sir?
There's another issue, too, that if you have a Sunday Christmas service and only 10 or 15% show up, it makes the 10 or 15% talk to each other and wonder what's up.
Yeah.
And you get people talking about, is this church really being effective? And then spiritual pride starts opening up among the 10 or 15%, and a whole can of worms starts.
Well, what you're really getting to, because you and I have grown up in churches like that, we both know the politics of church. If a church is not united around the very thing that Paul said the church should be built and united around, which is sound doctrine, so that everybody in the room believes the same thing, and then that sound doctrine ought to produce the fruit of the Spirit that is that brotherhood and fellowship and love for one another, sacrificial love for each other. If that's all happening, then those kind of church politics don't happen. If, in fact, you can get a room full of people who at least attempt the golden rule, do unto others as you'd have them do unto you, if you could approach esteem every man as better than yourself, if we could at least start to approach that, then you don't have to worry about those kind of church politics because everybody's concerned about the welfare of everybody else in the room. But as soon as it becomes a self-perpetuating corporation, which is what so many churches have become, where there's actually power involved with the leadership, then you do have the politics of people struggling and backbiting and trying to raise themselves up and become the important person and get the money and the power that goes with it. So I've said a million times, and I'll say it here again, starting into 2006, I'd rather be in a small room of people who all agree and who all love each other and are drawn by the sound doctrine, who are here for the reason of this word, then I'd like to be leading a church of 3,000 people who come there to be entertained, who can't wait to see a Sunday when I'm sick so that they can have the pulpit. You know? Poor Jeff, every time I call him and go, I'm sick, Jeff, it's on you. He goes, no! No, get well! Miracle healing! No! All right, all that being said, Luke 23. I told you last week that we were going to get to Herod this week. And I've brought a lot of historical information on King Herod. It's very easy in reading the Gospels to not differentiate between the Herods that are being spoken of. There are two primary Herods that show up in the Bible. There's Herod the Great, King Herod, the one who died when Jesus was an infant. And then there is his son, Herod Antipas, who we're going to see referred to here as a tetrarch. And we'll get into that in a moment. And then I'm going to read you some of the history of the Herodian kingship, because you need to understand the politics that are happening, again, leading to Jesus' death, because there is a very genuine power struggle going on here. And then we're going to look at God's hand, his sovereign hand in these events, and one more time see a perfect example of God using sinful, depraved sinners to achieve his ultimate goal, and in the process not save them, not enlighten them, but use them to accomplish the very thing he wants to do, which again is the way God has always worked. And then I'm going to read you a bunch of history, because there's nothing more exciting on the first day of the year than listening to Jim read. Luke 23, starting at verse 1. And the whole multitude of them arose, and they led Christ to Pontius Pilate. And they began to accuse him, saying, "We found this fellow perverting the nation and forbidding to give tribute to Caesar, saying that he himself is Christ, a king." That's what the word Messiah or Christ, Messiah is the Hebrew word, Christ the Greek word. They both mean the anointed of God. And all of the Hebrew scripture says that when Messiah comes, he would be a king, that he would set up the nation of Israel, that he would throw off all the other bondage that they had been in successively ever since the Egyptian captivity. And so now they're using that very charge against him. The Pharisees, who'd be very familiar with all that Old Testament scripture concerning the Messiah, are now using that as the charge against him to try to get Pilate to get involved in the politics. Essentially what they're saying is, if he's a king, then he's going to try to throw off the yoke of Rome. So Rome has a vested interest here. Rome needs to get involved here, because if he's a king, you're going to have an uprising among the people. That should be Rome's catalyst to want to get involved and shut that movement down. Also, by the way, if he is Christ the Messiah, and if he is the Son of God, then he is the God at the very moment that Caesar worship is on the rise. And Caesar is becoming a god in his own right. So you also have a competing focus for worship, pulling the focus away from Caesar and putting the focus on Christ. Now, this same question, the same paradigm showed up when they asked Jesus, should he pay taxes? Because the taxes were being collected oftentimes by Jews, like Matthew, and then that money was being given to Rome, who were keeping their thumb on the Jews, and so the question came up, should you pay taxes? And Jesus said, well, show me a coin. And they took out a coin, and he said, whose inscription, whose superscription is on the coin? And they said, it's Caesar's inscription. You remember what he said? Well, then render unto Caesar what is Caesar's. And had he stopped there, Rome would have had no problem with him. Had he just stopped there, they would have said, oh, well, we like him. He's got the people giving taxes to Caesar, which is exactly what we want out of him. But he didn't stop. He then said, and render unto God that which is God's. Brand new concept. That also means Caesar's not God. Give to Caesar what is Caesar's, but recognize that God exists and give to God what is God's. Worship God, but pay the taxes that belong to Caesar. And I think he was making also an earthly versus heavenly or spiritual distinction. He was saying, here on earth, man made money, and those men demand taxes out of you for the benefit you get from them. Well, then you give them back their money. They're the ones that printed it. Their face and name is right on it. It's their money. But also render unto God what belongs to God. And from that point forward, the politics between Jesus and Rome began building. So they reach a culmination here when they take him to Pilate and say he's forbidding to give tribute to Caesar. That's paying taxes to Caesar. Now, did Jesus, by the way, ever forbid anyone to give tribute to Caesar?
No.
So that's a lie. Remember last week we saw they were bringing in false witnesses. They couldn't find any two false witnesses that had the same testimony. They kept competing with each other and trying to build the story up. And so now they take him to Pilate, and they realize that Pilate's not particularly going to care about the particulars of their religion. If they start saying, well, he has likened himself to Jehovah, Pilate's going to go, so? That's your problem. You're the Pharisees. So they have to make it political. So they bring up this charge. He says you shouldn't pay tribute to Caesar. And he says that he himself is Christ, a king. So he's not going to pay taxes, and he wants to overthrow Rome. That's basically the charge. Pilate asked him, being Jesus, saying, are you king of the Jews? And he answered him and said, thou sayest. We've seen that answer a lot, haven't we? When he said that, verse 4, then Pilate said to the chief priests and to the people, I find no fault with this man. And they were even more fierce, saying, he stirs up the people, teaching throughout all Jewry, beginning from Galilee to this place. And when Pilate heard of Galilee, he asked whether the man was a Galilean. And as soon as he knew that he belonged to Herod's jurisdiction, he sent him to Herod, who himself also was in Jerusalem at that time. Why would Herod be at Jerusalem at that time?
It's Passover,
of course. So Herod goes up there to Jerusalem to make sure that he makes an appearance before all the people. And now we're going to talk about Herod and his background and his history and show you that he was not Jewish. He loved to pretend toward Jewry. And his father, you know, built the temple and everything else to curry favor with the Jews. But he was actually a Edomian and Arabian. And we'll read about that in a moment. Yes, you had your hand up.
I'm trying to remember, but in some of these languages, the word order, even for a question, isn't are you this or are you that? It's you are this. And it's in a tense
right.
or a case
right.
that indicates it's a question. But it's still an affirmation that you're going to say yes or no to, rather than our English. In other words, you are the preacher, question mark, versus are you the preacher?
Mm-hmm. Do you have your Greek text with you, Jeff?
That's how Greek reads. You are.
You are.
But in other words, what I'm saying is that it isn't like they're wondering. It's... they affirm this thing, and he says, right. it is as you say.
Right. They make the statement to give him the opportunity to deny it.
Yes.
And he, rather than deny, says, you've said it. In other words, that's a correct statement. Right. And you're absolutely right. In fact, the punctuation, as we know, is always added by the translator. Most of the earliest versions we have of the New Testament are in a form of Greek that are all capital letters. It's called the unctial Greek. And it's just all capital letters run together with no spaces. Sometimes there are small pen markings to show where sentences or paragraphs start and stop. And so translators had to go through and, in order to make it more readable, add things like the punctuation of the question mark. But you're right, in the Greek, the way the syntax runs, it could have been said as a statement or as a question.
Quite probably in Hebrew, too, because almost all non-English languages, it's like backwards to us.
Yeah, what's wrong with them? So let's talk about King Herod for a moment. I apologize for the amount of reading I'm going to do, but there's no other way to transmit all this, and if you don't get it all, get the tape. First off, Herod the Great. Herod the Great was the king who was alive when Jesus was born. Herod the Great was the king that the wise men came to. There, we're tying it into the Christmas season, finally. Jesus' father, Joseph, was warned in a dream that Herod wanted to kill the child, and so they went down to Egypt. And they stayed there until the angel came and said that Herod was dead, and they finally returned. When Herod died, his kingdom was divided up into basically four large colonies. And then over the area of Galilee, his son Herod Antipas got that area. And so he was a tetrarch, not the monarch, not the singular monarch, but tetra, four, one of four monarchs that ruled over that area. But the history of Herod, King Herod, how he became, being an Edomian, and how he became the king over the Israelites is a really interesting story. And he did it through a bit of political chicanery with a fellow we all know the name of, Mark Antony, and his girlfriend,
Cleopatra.
See, did you know that Cleopatra played into the politics and the history that led to the Herod that would try to kill Jesus? Well, that's all true. See, history is very interesting. What?
And they both died,
exactly right. Yes, apparently a mutual suicide pact, yeah. So, King Herod, born in 73 BC, was the pro-Roman king of the small Jewish state in the last decades of the Common Era. He started his career as a general, but the Roman statesman Mark Antony recognized him as the Jewish national leader. During a war against the Parthians, Herod was removed from the scene, but the Roman Senate made him king and gave him soldiers to seize the throne. As a, quote, friend and ally of the Romans, unquote, he was not a truly independent king. However, Rome allowed him a domestic policy of his own, and although Herod tried to respect the pious feelings of his subjects, many of them were not content with his rule, which ended in terror. He was succeeded by his sons. Herod was born in 73 BC as the son of a man from Edomia named Antipater and a woman named Cypris, who was the daughter of an Arabian sheik. There's no Jewish blood going on there. Antipater was an adherent of a fellow named Hyrcanus. Have you heard of John Hyrcanus? familiar with him. He was a Jewish leader, teacher, high priest during that period, who had a great deal of influence on Antipater, who was the father of Herod. And so these two princes, Hyrcanus and Antipater, both struggled to become the king of Judea, the country inhabited by the descendants of Edom. You've heard a lot about Edom and Moab, which are in the wilderness off to the east of Jerusalem. You've got the Rocky Mountain Range there, and you've got Edom and Moab, Ammon in that area. The word Edomian has its roots in Edom. So these are Edomites. There was little racial difference between the Judeans and the Edomites, but they were usually in conflict. When Judea pulled together under Saul, they campaigned against the Edomites for control of the port of Ezion-Geber, and the copper mines of Wadi Araba were another bone of contention. Under King David, the country of Edom, that part that is south of Palestine, was subdued and then garrisoned. And then during the reign of Solomon, the mines and the port were very active. After the breakup of Judea into two separate kingdoms, Edom was able to gain its freedom. This situation went through several reversals until the Judeans and the Israelites were taken captive in Babylon, and then the Edomites moved into South Palestine, making Hebron their capital. When Alexander the Great died and his empire fell apart, the Nabataeans moved into the Jordanian part of Edom, and the Edomian community was pushed into a smaller area of Palestine. Any of that sound familiar? The Jews and the Edomite, Esauites, Arabs in the same area, fighting over land and pushing each other into smaller and smaller areas. Aren't you glad that's over? Still going on today. The center of world politics and the most likely place where World War III could erupt is over there on that little sliver of land, still arguing about who's going to control Palestine. Still going on over there. And it doesn't matter how many times the nation of Israel gives up a piece of land and says, all right, you can have the Golan Heights, or okay, you can have the disputed territories. They go, well, we now want more. And now the prime minister of Iran is saying, well, we're just going to push Israel off the map. Even though this is history, this is still history that's continuing to this day, because the very people who are continuing the fight over there right now have this history. And generation after generation have taught their children and the following generations hatred for that other group. And that hatred goes way, way back, which is why it's going to take more than President Clinton getting each of the leaders to come out and shake hands on the White House lawn and draw a peace pact. It's going to take more than that to stop the disruption that's going on in the Middle East. That disruption goes all the way back here and, of course, leads to the death of all the children to try to kill Christ. So what have we learned from history? That we've learned nothing from history. That's exactly right. Very good, dear. When Alexander the Great died and the empire fell apart, the Nabataeans moved into the Jordanian area of Edom, and the Edomian community was pushed into a smaller area of Palestine. In 109 BC, John Hyrcanus conquered the Edomians, or the remnant of the Edomites, and forced them to accept Judaism. So the Edomites that were still left there, the Edomians that were left in that area during the time that John Hyrcanus rose up as high priest, he forced them, since they were living in that area of Palestine, to accept Judaism, even though they were not historically Jews by blood. They continued to own their own land until their governor, Antipater, sided with Hyrcanus II against Aristobulus for control of Judea. When the Romans arrived in Syria, Julius Caesar, in 47 BC, rewarded Antipater with the procuratorship of Judea, Samaria, and Galilee. Antipater, this is Herod's father, was also made a Roman citizen, which at that time was an important honor. So you've got this guy, perfectly politically aligned, who is a Roman citizen, who has also accepted Judaism because of the pressure of John Hyrcanus, and he has also settled the politics where he has been given the procuratorship, which is like a governorship, of that area that the Jews are living in. See the politics building? Now, none of this, by the way, is by mistake. You can see behind the scenes the hand of God setting up the perfect political environment into which his son would arrive in order that his son would be, on this particular Passover, that he would be on the cross, just as Passover began, that he would go into the grave exactly as the feast of unleavened bread began. At the beginning of the first fruits, he came up out of the grave so that Paul would call him the first fruit of the resurrection. And 50 days later, the church, right on time at Pentecost, the Holy Spirit fell and the church was conceived. And it was very important that that all fall in a calendar year where all of those dates lined up exactly, giving Jesus that 3 days, three nights in the tomb that were necessary for him to accomplish everything that was predicted by him. So even though it looks like this is just worldly politics bubbling over here, what you've really got is the hand of God preparing everybody, according to the book of Acts, and we'll look at it in a minute. Peter stands up on the day of Pentecost and says that Pontius Pilate and the Jews and the people were all assembled to do precisely what God's hand had ordained to be done. So all of these politics are lining up on purpose. It's a case, writes this particular historian, it's a classic case of the tail wagging the dog. The remnant of Idumea became the ruler of Judea. And the Judeans were the very people who had allowed the Idumeans to remain if they had accepted Judaism. And then the Idumeans ended up ruling over them. Antipater was followed by his son, who was later called Herod the Great. It can be argued that Edom ceased to exist in 109 BCE with John Hyrcanus or 47 BC with Antipater, but in reality, they were simply absorbed into the Judeans. In the conflict, the Roman general Pompey, you've heard of Pompey, yes, okay. Little did you know this is all going to tie into the Bible. In this conflict, the Roman general Pompey intervened in Hyrcanus' favor. Having favored the winning side in the conflict, Antipater's star rose, especially since he cooperated with the Romans as much as possible. In the civil war between Pompey and Julius Caesar, Hyrcanus and Antipater sided with Julius Caesar, for which especially the courtier was rewarded. And in 47 BC, he was appointed as the regent, and he received his Roman citizenship. It was obvious that Antipater was the real power behind Hyrcanus' throne. He managed to secure the appointment of his young son Herod to the important task of governor of Galilee. The boy was 16 years old when he was made governor of Galilee. The boy, who was only 16, launched his small crusade against the bandits in the area, which made him very popular with the populace, but made him rather unpopular with the Sanhedrin, which is interesting. What does that tell you? It means they were behind it. On March 15th, 44 BC, Caesar was murdered. And the new leaders in Rome were Caesar's nephew, Octavian, and Caesar's powerful second-in-command, Mark Antony. Or Mark Antony, no TH in there. Mark Antony. Later to marry Jennifer Lopez. Right? Isn't that what happened? Right? I'm sorry. Caesar's powerful second-in-command was Mark Antony. They announced that they would punish Caesar's murderers, who were Brutus and Cassius, who had... Et tu, Brute. Exactly. That's what he said when they came and stabbed him. And he was so surprised, Caesar was, that Brutus would also join in and said, Et tu, Brute. My daughter quoting Shakespeare, thank you. Homeschool, that's what that is. And so in the struggle, in looking for Brutus and Cassius, who had fled to the east, Cassius ordered all the provinces and the principalities to pay money for their struggle against Octavian and Mark Antony, and Judea had to pay some 15,000 kilograms of silver. Antipater and his sons had to take harsh measures to get the money, and in the ensuing troubles, Antipater was killed. With Roman help, Herod killed his father's murderer. And in 43, Hyrcanus' nephew Antigonus tried to obtain the throne. Herod defeated him and secured the continuity of the line of Hyrcanus by marrying Hyrcanus' daughter, Miriam. Are you following the politics still? So now you've got Herod taking a first wife in his teens still, and he marries the daughter of John Hyrcanus, and that cements the two lines that had been vying for power for the throne in Judea. That cements the two families. Of course, the young man was not blind to the fact that this marriage greatly enhanced his own claim to the throne. Meanwhile, Octavian and Mark Antony had defeated Brutus and Cassius at Philippi. Herod managed to convince Mark Antony, who made a tour through the eastern provinces that had supported Caesar's murderers, that his father had been forced to support their side. The Roman leader was convinced, and he awarded Herod with the title of Tetrarch of Galilee, a title that was commonly used for leaders of parts of vassal kingdoms. Herod's brother Phasael was to be the Tetrarch of Jerusalem. Hyrcanus remained the national leader in name only. This appointment caused a lot of resentment among the Jews. After all, Herod was not a Jew. He was a son of a man from Idumea. And although Antipater had been a pious man who had worshipped the Jewish God sincerely, the Jews had always looked down upon the Idumeans as racially impure. Worse, Herod had an Arabian mother, and it was commonly held that one could only be a Jew if he was born to a Jewish mother. When war broke out between the Romans and the Parthians in Iran and Mesopotamia, the Jewish populace joined the latter, they joined the Parthians, and in 40, Hyrcanus was taken prisoner and brought to the Parthian capital, Babylon. Antigonus became king in his place. Phasael committed suicide. Herod managed to escape and went to Rome, where he persuaded Octavian and the Senate to order Mark Antony to restore him, and so it happened. After Mark Antony and his lieutenants had driven away the Parthians, Herod was brought back to Jerusalem by two legions. Antigonus was defeated, and after he had besieged and captured Jerusalem, he had defeated the last opposition, and Herod could start his reign as the sole ruler in Judea. He assumed the title Basileus, which is the highest possible title, Herod the Great. So how did he become the king over the Jews? By force and by Roman politics. Can you see why the Jews would not like him? Can you see why they wouldn't like being ruled by a vassal king whose mother was Arabian, whose father was of mixed descent, Idumean? You can see why they would not have any great love for Herod. Herod's monarchy was based on foreign weapons. The start of his rule had been marked by bloodshed. His first aim was to establish his rule on a more solid base. Almost immediately, he sent envoys to the Parthian king to get Hyrcanus back from Babylon. The Parthian king was happy to let the old man go because he was becoming dangerously popular among the Jews living in Babylonia. Although Hyrcanus was unfit to become high priest again, Herod kept his father-in-law in high esteem. The support of the old monarch gave an appearance of legality to his own rule. The new king started an extensive building program. Jews could take pride in the new walls of Jerusalem and in the citadel that guarded its temple. This fortress, called Antonia, in order to please Herod's patron, Mark Antony. Coins were minted in his own name, and they showed an incense burner on a tripod intended to signify Herod's care for his Orthodox Jewish cult practices. These coins had a Greek legend that said Herodi Basileus, or Herod the Great. Then he goes on to talk about the gifts that came. There were gifts that came from Mark Antony. The Egyptian queen Cleopatra sent him gifts. He had a great deal of political connection with Rome and with Egypt through Cleopatra. These gifts were Herod's undoing. The relations between, on one hand, Mark Antony and Cleopatra there in the east, and on the other hand, Octavian and the Senate in the west became strained. Civil war broke out in 31 BC. It didn't last very long. In August, the western leaders defeated the eastern leader, who fled to Alexandria. And for the first time in his life, Herod had aligned himself with a loser. He managed to solve the problem, however. First, he had Hyrcanus executed, making sure that no one else could claim his throne. Then he sailed to the island of Rhodes, where he met Octavian. In a brilliant speech, Herod boasted of his loyalty to Mark Antony and promised that same loyalty to the new master of the Roman Empire. Octavian was impressed by the man's audacity. He confirmed Herod's monarchy, and he even added the coast of Judea and Samaria to his realm. Actually, Octavian didn't have much choice. His opponents were still alive, and if he were to pursue them to Egypt, Herod could be a useful ally. As it turned out, Mark Antony and Cleopatra preferred death to surrender, and Octavian became the only ruler in the Roman world, and he changed his name to
Augustus.
He became Augustus Caesar, after whom the month August is now named, the same as the month July after Julius Caesar. So Herod's position was still insecure. He continued his building policy to win the hearts of his subjects. In Jerusalem, the king built a new market and an amphitheater, an indoor theater, a new building where the Sanhedrin could convene, a new royal palace, and last but not least, in 20 BC, he started to rebuild the temple. The temple into which Jesus walked was Herod's temple. Solomon's temple had been twice destroyed, and so Herod came in order to win favor with the Jewish people and built this absolutely magnificent temple, so splendid, in fact, that when Jesus walked into it just prior to his death, that his apostles and disciples showed it to him and said, "Look at this wonderful temple." And his response was, "Tear down this temple, and in 3 days I'll raise it up again." And when the false witnesses came in, as we saw last week, to bring charges against Jesus, one of the charges they brought was, "He said if you tear down the temple, he'll build it up in 3 days." And of course, the idea of tearing down the temple was both politically and spiritually a bad move. But he wasn't speaking of the physical temple, he was speaking of the temple of his body. "Tear down this temple, and in 3 days I'll raise it up again." That was the temple Jesus walked into. But Herod's crowning achievement was the splendid new port that he built called Caesarea. You find the name Caesarea in the Bible, in the New Testament, named, of course, after Caesar, pretty obvious. The magnificent and opulent city was dedicated in 9 BC, and it was built to rival Alexandria in bringing trade in from Arabia. In 23 BC, Ituria and the Golan Heights were added to Herod's realms. 20 other distinct districts were then added, and he continued his building projects. With his building projects, the expansion of his territories, the establishment of a sound bureaucracy, and the development of economic resources, he did much for his country, at least on a material level. The standing of his country, foreign and at home, was certainly enhanced. However, many of his projects won him the bitter hatred of the Orthodox Jews, who disliked Herod's Greek taste, a taste that showed not only in his building projects, but also in several transgressions of the Mosaic Law. The Orthodox Jews were not the only ones who came to hate the new king. The Sadducees hated him because he had terminated the rule of the old royal house, to which many of them had been related, and so their own influence in the Sanhedrin was curtailed. The Pharisees despised any ruler who despised the law of Moses, and probably all of his subjects resented his excessive taxation. According to Josephus, which is where I've gotten most of this material, Flavius Josephus wrote that there were two taxes in kind at annual rates that were equivalent to 10.7% and 8.6%. Put it together, they were paying close to 19% of all their money to Herod for his building and expanding. It comes as no surprise that Herod sometimes had to revert to violence, employing mercenaries and a secret police force in order to enforce the order. On moments like that, it became clear to anyone that Herod was not a Jewish, but a Roman king. He had become the ruler of the Jews with Roman help, and he boasted that he was Philo Kaiser. We know this word, philos. What's philos? What is it? No, it's phileo.
Brother.
Brother. Philos, brother. See that word, Kaiser, look familiar to you? That, of course, is a Greek version of Caesar, but that word stuck around as long as World War I. Kaiser Wilhelm. And then, of course, it made its way north after the Germanic people picked it up as Kaiser. It made its way north into the Russian language as Tsar. All those words all come from Caesar, and he became known as Philo Kaiser, which was friend of Caesar, which was not going to make the Jews happy. And on top of the gate of the new temple, a golden eagle was erected, a symbol of Roman power in the heart of the holy city, at the gate that led into the temple, the place where the Jews would go to worship God. They erected a golden eagle, a sign of imperial power. So even to go into the temple, they were consciously aware that Roman dominion was over their heads. And you can see why they would not like that. All of this is going to play into, as you get a feel for the different politics going on here, that for the first time, Pontius Pilate and King Herod, who had always disliked each other, they became friends from the day that they both made fun of Jesus. Because nothing unites people faster than a common enemy. And then again, like I said, the book of Acts is going to pick it up and say, Pontius Pilate and Herod did whatsoever your hand determined to be done. Worse, Augustus ordered and paid the priests of the temple to sacrifice twice a day on behalf of himself. The Jewish populace started to believe rumors that their pagan rulers had violated Jewish tombs and were stealing golden objects from the tombs of David and Solomon. Herod concluded 10 marriages, all for political purposes. And while most historians believe they were probably all unhappy marriages, there's then a list of his wives that we won't go through, outside of pointing out that there was a Samaritan woman named Malthus, M-A-L-T-H-A-C-E. She was married in 28 B.C., died somewhere around 4 or 5 B.C., and they had two children together, Antipas and Archelaus. And those two boys are going to become two of the tetrarchs that are going to fight for political power. And it is going to be Antipas, Herod Antipas, who is going to be responsible for lopping off the head of John the Baptist. So this is important. Herod's reign ended in terror. The monastery at Qumran, the home of the Essenes, where the Qumran caves, where the Dead Sea Scrolls were found, they suffered a violent and deliberate destruction by fire in 8 BC, for which Herod may have been responsible. When the king fell ill, two popular teachers, Judas and Matthias, incited their pupils to remove the golden eagle from the entrance of the temple. After all, according to the Ten Commandments, it was a sin to make idols. The teachers and the pupils were burned alive. Some Jewish scholars have discovered that 26 generations had passed since the creation, and there was a well-known prophecy that the Messiah was going to deliver Israel from its foreign rulers in the 27th generation. The story about the slaughter of infants of Bethlehem in the second chapter of the Gospel of Matthew is not known from other sources, but it would certainly have been totally in character for the late Herod to commit such a terrible act. So let's go read about that now. This is the point at which history and the Bible connect. So let's go look at Matthew 2. If we don't make it through all of this morning, we'll pick it up next week. The last sentence that I read for you out of this book I was reading from says that there are no sources outside of the Bible that talk about what's commonly called the slaughter of the innocents, the killing of all the children. And so there have been people who have questioned whether or not it was historically accurate. But as you're going to see, every other reference to Herod lines up exactly with history. And so there's no reason not to believe that the slaughter of the innocents was true. It may also be that because it was in such a limited area, that this particular thing would have been minor in comparison to the other things that Herod was so infamous for doing that it just simply didn't end up in any of the history books. And of course, history books, as you well know, are written by the winners. And so oftentimes things that do not shine a positive light on the person being written about are just sort of swept under the rug. But it is recounted in Matthew 2, and everything else surrounding it is so accurate that there's no reason to believe that it wasn't true. Chapter 2, verse 1 of Matthew. Now when Jesus was born in Bethlehem of Judea, in the days of Herod the king, now we know which Herod that is, this is Herod the Great, behold, there came wise men from the east to Jerusalem, saying, where is he that is born king of the Jews? For we have seen his star in the east, and we are come to worship him. When Herod the king had heard these things, he was troubled, and all Jerusalem with him. Can you see now why he would be troubled? Because if you've got wise men coming from the east, and they're coming to see Herod wanting to know where the king of the Jews is, and he's not Jewish, he's Edomian, but the king of the Jews has been born, and there's a prophecy, and there's a star, you can see why this is troubling him. He's worked really, really hard to have control of this area, which is why I read all that material building up to this point. He has made political alliances through Rome and down into Egypt, and when he picked the wrong side, he would go back and make such impassioned speeches to the new leaders that he kept ending up back on that throne. And then he hears that the fulfillment of a prophecy has come. The king of the Jews is on the planet right now, somewhere in his realm. You can see why he'd be mighty upset. When Herod the king had heard all these things, he was troubled, and all Jerusalem with him. Verse 4, and when he had gathered all the chief priests and the scribes of the people together, he demanded of them where Christ should be born. Now, how would they know?
Prophecy.
The prophecy. It's in the book of Micah. Micah 5:2. Somebody want to look that up real quick? They said unto him, in Bethlehem of Judea, for thus it is written by the prophet. Micah 5:2, somebody got it there? You got it, Tom?
Ooh, I don't know if I can say that word.
Take a stab.
But you, Bethlehem Ephratath.
Yeah, okay. Ephratath.
Though you are small among the clans of Judah, out of you will come for me one who will be ruler over Israel, whose origins are from of old, from ancient times.
Okay, so there's the prophecy, as clear as it can be, that out of Bethlehem Ephratah is going to come the leader, the ruler, the king of the Jews. So that's already in the prophecy, so that he could ask his scribes and chief priests, now where is the king of the Jews supposed to be born? And they could tell him, in Bethlehem. Well, good, he's got a region to work with now, and it falls under his jurisdiction. In verse 6, Matthew quotes it, and thou Bethlehem in the land of Judah art not least among the princes of Judah, for out of thee shall come a governor that shall rule my people Israel. Then Herod, when he had privately called the wise men, inquired of them diligently what time the star appeared. And he sent them to Bethlehem and said, go and search diligently for the baby in a manger.
No, it says child.
No, it says young child. Go search for the young child. How would they know it was a young child by then?
It took them a while for them to get there.
Yeah, it took a while for them to get there. They saw a star. They were in the east, and they see a star over Bethlehem. There was no train or plane to take. They're going by camel train. And apparently, they said that they first saw the star 2 years ago because Herod's going to kill all the children 2 years and under. So you're not going to see any language of baby in a manger, and you're not going to see any language of them joining the shepherds in the manger. So he sent them to Bethlehem and said, go and search diligently for the young child. When you have found him, bring me word again that I may come and worship him also. Was Herod planning to come and worship him also?
No.
No. He said, tell me where the child is. I'm going to kill him. But he was a liar. He was a deceiver. And he said, tell me where they are. So, oh, I'd love to come worship him too. When they had heard the king, they departed. And lo, the star which they saw in the east went before them till it came and stood over where the young child was. And when they saw the star, they rejoiced with exceeding great joy. And when they were come into the house, into the what?
The house.
Into the house. Not the manger outside, the inn. And when they were come into the house, they saw the young child with Mary his mother. And they fell down and they worshipped him. When they had opened their treasures, they presented unto him gold and frankincense and myrrh. And then being warned of God in a dream that they should not return to Herod, they departed into their own country another way. And when they were departed, behold, the angel of the Lord appeared unto Joseph in a dream and said, arise and take the young child and his mother and flee into Egypt and be thou there until I bring thee word, for Herod will seek the young child to destroy him. When he arose, he took the young child and his mother by night and departed into Egypt. And he was there until the death of Herod, that it might be fulfilled which was spoken of the Lord by the prophet, saying, out of Egypt have I called my son. That's Hosea 11, I believe. Then Herod, when he saw that he was mocked by the wise men, was exceeding wroth, and sent forth and slew all the children that were in Bethlehem and in all the coast thereof, from 2 years old and under, according to the time which he had diligently inquired of the wise men. So the wise men clearly said 2 years. Then was fulfilled that which was spoken by Jeremiah the prophet, saying, in Ramah there was a voice heard, lamentation and weeping, and great mourning, Rachel weeping for her children, and would not be comforted because they were not. That's Jeremiah 31:15. But when Herod was dead, behold, an angel of the Lord appeared in a dream to Joseph in Egypt, saying, arise and take the young child and his mother and go into the land of Israel, for they are dead which sought the young child's life. And he arose and he took the young child and his mother and came into the land of Israel. But when he heard that Archelaus, was reigning in Judea in the room of his father Herod, he was afraid to go there. Notwithstanding, being warned of God in a dream, he turned aside into the parts of Galilee, and he came to dwell in a city called Nazareth, that it might be fulfilled which was spoken by the prophets, that he would be called a Nazarene. When he went into the area of Galilee, he was then in the area of the tetrarch Herod Antipas, one of the sons of Herod. And that is the Herod Antipas who we'll see next week cuts off John Baptist's head. And then this is the one who Pontius Pilate, who when he hears that Jesus is a Galilean, says, oh, well, then you fall under the jurisdiction of Herod. And he sends Jesus to Herod. You got all that? You see the politics involved in all that, and the history? Because there's a shuffling going on here. Rome really doesn't want to touch this. They don't have anything to really charge the man with. And you have to remember that Rome was very involved in its law. It had a very complex legal system. It's why Paul, when he was being stoned and sent to Felix the governor, that he then pled to Caesar and said, I am a Roman citizen. I am a born free man. And he pled to Caesar, and Felix was quite disturbed and upset to find out that he had just punished and beaten a Roman citizen. Not good, not going to look good. And so they're very involved in keeping their hands clean, as it were. And so Pontius Pilate, who's a governor over a bunch of people who don't particularly like him anyway, also has to answer to Rome if he kills an innocent man. And yet he's got the Jews saying, kill him on the basis of our religion, which Pontius Pilate really doesn't care about the religious aspects of it. And so they say, well, he's a seditionist. He doesn't want to pay taxes. He's going to become a king. He's going to overthrow Rome. And he kind of looks for a way out and goes, Galilee, I heard Galilee. Okay, you're a Galilean. Well, then you're going to go to Herod. You are Herod's problem. But that's not the Herod that killed the babies. This is his son, who is a tetrarch. He is a ruler over one portion of it, whereas his brother is the tetrarch over the area of Jerusalem. That again, Peter is going to stand up on the day of Pentecost and say that Herod Antipas, and Pontius Pilate, and all the people gathered together to do whatsoever your hand and your counsel determined should be done. So there's no mistakes here. God sent him into Egypt, God brought him out of Egypt, and God brought him to Galilee so that he would be called a Nazarene, all in fulfillment of prophecy, but all so that he would die on that particular Passover, so that he would be in the grave on that particular Feast of Unleavened Bread, so that he would rise up on that particular Feast of First Fruits, and 50 days later, Peter would stand up and announce the inception of the church. All of this is God's sovereign hand working not only in saved people and redeemed people, but also working through evil, sinful, depraved people to accomplish the very thing he intended to do, which was save Jeff, save Elizabeth. You get the picture? So our God is so sovereign, as I keep on saying, that he is perfectly capable and willing to move kings and kingdoms and empires and politics. And little did we all know when we were watching Elizabeth Taylor on the barge going down the river with, who was it? Richard Burton. Yeah, showing your age. Little did we know that all of that was actually God behind the scenes creating the political structure into which he would deliver his son, so that his son would be delivered for us. And that's a mighty sovereign God. And as I've often said, a God that sovereign can take care of you. A God that sovereign can make sure that you make it through another day. And God that sovereign can make sure you make it all the way to your appointed destiny in heaven, because he's been in plenty of control here on earth. He's in complete control of everything that happens in his universe. So to bring it full circle, I say, you know, show up once a week and say thanks, because that God is working on your behalf all the time. And if you want to show up on Wednesdays too, hey, that's a plus. Next week then, we will pick up right there. Herod has died. Next week I'm going to read about Herod Antipas and tell you about how he ends up marrying his niece, who was also his brother's ex-wife. A little bit of inbreeding going on there. And that's the very reason that John the Baptist called him out and told him it was not right that he should have her for his wife. And that's the beginning of the conflict between Herod Antipas and John the Baptist. So we'll get to all that too.
On behalf of everyone at Grace Christian Assembly, we thank you for listening to this week's Salvation by Grace message. Remember to visit us on the internet at www.salvationbygrace.org. and we invite you to join us next time when we gather around the Word and study the sovereign grace of God.